Pearl Harbor, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, the sinking of the Lusitania, 9/11, there is widespread belief that in all cases these incidents were made or at least allowed to happen on purpose in order to foster support for war. With the recent anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks having come and gone, and with a possible conflict with Syria on the horizon, we'll talk with retired journalist and media critic Barry Zwicker about the history and sophistication behind fabricated disasters known as false flags. Then, we'll talk with an Ottawa activist named David Long about the efforts of himself and others to force the Canadian government to address what he sees as the implausibility of the official narrative of the September 11th attacks. On today's program, False Flags and Confronting 9/11, bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 13th, 2012. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. The UN Security Council condemned North Korea Wednesday for its launch of a ballistic missile and is discussing how to respond to this act on the part of Pyongyang. Moroccan UN Ambassador Mohamed Loulichi, this month's president of the Security Council, was quoted as saying, "Members of the Security Council condemned this launch, which is a clear violation of Security Council Resolutions 1718 and 1874. White House spokesman Jay Carney told reporters, quote, it has chosen not to abide by its international obligations, and therefore there will be consequences for that. According to a senior Western diplomat who spoke on condition of anonymity, the U.S., the EU, Japan, and South Korea are seeking to expand Western sanctions against Pyongyang. But China traditionally acts in a protective way toward North Korea on the Security Council and could easily veto a resolution regarding Pyongyang. The senior envoy stated he hoped a new Security Council resolution could be arrived at by the end of this week, but that, quote, exactly what the Chinese will be prepared to accept in form and substance is not yet clear. And that story comes to us from Reuters. At a pretrial hearing into the court-martial of U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning on Tuesday, his attorney argued he was mistreated by his former jailers at the Marine Corps brig at Quantico in order to protect them against recriminations from their superiors. David E. Coombs stated the jailers ignored medical advice that he was not at risk of hurting himself or anyone else and kept him locked in a tiny cell for 23 hours a day. For months, Manning was placed in either suicide watch or injury prevention status. Coombs said, quote, the fact that Manning's spirit is not broken is amazing. Being treated as a zoo animal for that period of time has to weigh heavily on the psyche, unquote. One of the prosecutors, Army Major Ashton Fine, countered that these conditions were placed on Manning for the prisoner's protection. Arguing the military's case, Fine said there was no evidence of extreme treatment of Manning and that there were only 7 days that Manning was improperly placed on suicide watch, time for which Manning should get credit at sentencing. Manning was arrested in May of 2010 in Iraq for leaking sensitive documents to the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. If convicted of the most serious charges against him, including aiding the enemy, he faces life in prison. That story comes to us from the Washington Post. HSBC had to pay $1.9 billion as part of a settlement over allegedly allowing terrorists to move money through the financial system. The bank's chief executive, Stuart Gulliver, said he was profoundly sorry for the bank's blatant failure to implement money laundering controls and for willfully flouting U.S. sanctions. Speaking at a New York press conference hours later, Assistant Attorney General Lanny Brewer explained that Mexican drug traffickers laundered at least $881 million of drug money through the HSBC accounts. The fine is the largest ever for such an offense and exceeds £940 million anticipated when the allegations first surfaced in a U.S. Senate report last summer. The HSBC case is part of a comprehensive investigation led by the Justice Department, the Treasury, and the Manhattan prosecutors into the laundering of money through the U.S. financial system. The inquiry has so far ensnared six foreign banks in recent years, including Credit Suisse and Barclays. And that comes to us from the New York Times and the UK Guardian. This last December 7th marked the 71st anniversary of the attacks on Pearl Harbor. This is the argument goes that this was a sneak attack that led to the United States entering into the Second World War. And this, according to my next guest, is just one instance of many so-called false flag attacks that have allowed the United States to launch wars or to join wars. And in fact, every U.S., according to this guest, every U.S. launched war that has taken place in history, with the exception of the War of 1812, was initiated by a false flag attack. So to tell us a little bit about some of the history of false flag attacks, including one of the most notorious of all, 9/11, is Barry Zwicker. So, Barry, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
Okay, so I just mentioned Pearl Harbor for a second. Do you want to maybe outline just a couple of brief comments about Pearl Harbor and reasons why we should be suspicious that that was a sneak attack as opposed to something planned in advance?
Yes, Pearl Harbor is so well known that it's a good example, and also the attack on Pearl Harbor, it was an attack. We have to be careful with our language, and we must never say the attack of 9/11 or the attacks of 9/11. We'll get into that. But anyway, it was historic because the United States had not yet joined Britain and Canada and other countries in fighting against Hitler's Nazism. Hitler rolled into Poland in September 1939, and here it was already December 1941, and the United States was not in the war against Hitler. That was because of a couple of reasons. One, America had a long history of isolationism dating back to its founding when it wanted not to be entangled in the European wars in the 1700s, and also the elite of the United States, the capitalists, they actually loved Hitler. They were mainly fascistic, supportive of Hitler, and fanatically opposed to communism, and so that between the public and the elites, according to the Gallup poll, the day before Pearl Harbor, only 16% of Americans agreed that the United States should join World War II, believe it or not. The day after Pearl Harbor, 1 million men volunteered to serve. It was a total game changer. So, so people know about it, and they know that it did cause the advent of the USA into World War II. But most people still think that it was strictly a sneak attack. And as an example of how false history, because it wasn't a sneak attack, we'll just mention briefly about that. The Americans had broken the Japanese military codes, had totally broken them. This and a lot of other really important and indubitable information about Pearl Harbor is in a fabulous book called Day of Deceit by Robert B. Stinnett, two N's, two T's. And so the Americans had broken the Japanese codes, and the Americans knew the Japanese fleet was steaming toward Pearl Harbor, and the Americans had been working to encourage Japanese aggression. We should never take away from the fact that it was Japanese aggression. It was a militaristic, imperialistic power, Japan was, and it absolutely carried out the attack. But it was provoked deliberately by the United States for almost a year prior in many, many ways. And when and then the Americans, and this was under the complete authority of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he took extraordinary steps to make sure that it was a major stunning attack. For instance, just one thing. The U.S. Naval Headquarters used to be at San Diego. He had the U.S. Naval Headquarters moved to the vulnerable Pearl Harbor way off in Hawaii. That really helped set things up. And so then you come down to this past Saturday, rather this past Friday, December the 7th. The Globe and Mail on page 2 has a daily feature called A Moment in Time. And on last Friday, the Globe reproduced false history under the heading Clear Skies Over Oahu, and it said that these six Japanese aircraft carriers and so on and so on had traveled 5,000 kilometers over 12 days without being detected. Completely wrong. They were detected.
Demonstrably wrong.
Pardon?
This is demonstrably wrong.
Demonstrably wrong. Demonstrably. And so then reconnaissance planes found Pearl slumbering and completely unaware. That was planned because the commander was kept in the dark. His name was Kimmel. His grandson, who works for the FBI, is still trying to clear Kimmel's name. There were two of them, husband and Kimmel, two commanders who were thoroughly disgraced by this, but they were set up. They were really patsies, and so the Globe and Mail, to finish up, the Globe and Mail has this sort of factoid that even the Japanese hadn't counted on their opponent, that was the commander, spending a lazy Hawaiian Sunday sleeping in and goofing off. The attack preempted the base commander's regular golf date, and that just paints the Americans as completely asleep. And the total reverse was true. At the highest levels, America just virtually helped that to happen. So that's the kind of that's the kind of thing that goes on with a false flag operation.
And not just for Pearl Harbor, but other incidents as well. Now, just to clarify, you mentioned Robert B. Stinnett, who had taken 17 years compiling the case using tens of thousands of classified documents, correct? Now, how is it that the media, that this information is not more accessible to people?
Well, I think that this is a very, very good question, because it's also applicable to other false flag operations and other major secrets in history, secrets that are military. You know, we get a phrase, it's not a military secret, you know. Well, military secret is just the gold standard of secrecy. And of course, intelligence agencies and spies down through history have been very, very dark about what they do. And most of them are sworn to privacy and secrecy and keep their mouths shut right into the grave. And most of them do that. So there's first of all, a wall of secrecy around the perpetrators of all these operations. And there certainly was with FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He had a trusted lieutenant who coordinated the planning for this. And There's no way they were going to tell anybody about it at the time, afterwards, or ever. So that it took one guy, Robert B., you said Stinnett, and maybe that's the way his name is pronounced, and he had been a U.S. Navy officer, and after Pearl Harbor, he had heard rumblings that something was fishy, and it took this one guy who was not a professional writer. He was not a professional historian. He just had a burning interest in this that he developed, and that's why it took him 17 years. He did have some luck, because during the time he was researching it, the U.S. Naval Archives were moved from one location to another. I forget what the locations were. But anyway, in the course of this, they uncovered dusty boxes and identified them as having to do with Pearl Harbor. And those nobody might have found for a long time, but they came to light because of that move, and he got access to them. He submitted, I believe, hundreds of Freedom of Information requests to get the information. He cross-checked it six ways from Sunday. His is absolutely the best, the most complete book on Pearl Harbor, and it shows that FDR wanted the Japanese to fire the first shot and thereby could be labeled clearly the aggressor of a sneak attack, that FDR was then ready to go on radio, which was the big medium then, and call a day of infamy. And that was a phrase that resonates to this day. These are very powerful events, and the perpetrators use very powerful language to embed them in the consciousness of everybody.
It is a psychological operation at its root. I mean, it's a matter of trying to terrify or shock people to such an extent that they'll become more susceptible to the idea of engaging in warfare, which is not something that that people are inclined to go through with, right?
Well, yes and no, I'd say. In the case of Pearl Harbor, the most noticeable characteristic of it was that it was a sneak attack, a surprise attack. Everyone, you know, Pearl Harbor, you know, if you did a word association test for people and say Pearl Harbor, they'd say sneak attack. And so that has the power of surprise. It's just stunning. It was the same with the gunpowder plot of 1605, where certain Roman Catholics who were unhappy about the political situation in England were alleged to have planned to blow up the Parliament buildings with the King and Queen and House of Lords and everybody inside. That was a total surprise, and it was stunning. But other times, it's not a complete surprise that is the case. If you take just currently with Syria, the Americans are saying that Assad is planning to use chemical weapons, and this is being just reverberating in the mainstream media around the world almost every day now.
Like with Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction 10 years ago.
They're replaying the Iraq thing. They don't have any. Even the Americans haven't brought forth any particular evidence. It's just words. Just words. And I noticed yesterday that Assad has gone to the UN, and he has sent a letter to the UN saying he fears an American false flag attack. He's actually using that terminology. But so what you do is, with Iraq and with Syria, you build up this, the drums of war beat, the rhetoric beats, the claims are poured out, and the public mind is pummeled with all this preparatory stuff for war. And by the time something happens, the public is pretty well sold that this horrible dictator had to be deposed, the freedom fighters had to win, blah, blah, blah. You know? So you have, you could, among many other categorizations of false flag ops, you could divide it into two kinds. Complete, iconic, stunning surprise, and drums beating and beating and beating prior to the false flag operation being done, and simply being the cherry on top of the sundae that quote, proves, unquote, to everybody that all this drum beating was justified.
Now, it sounds like you've got a fairly solid grasp of that technology, if you will, of false flags as a tool for perpetuating wars. And I guess I'm wondering, I mean, is the academic arena aware of this this understanding themselves? I mean, would you not see within our society some sort of a guard or that would, you know, I know, a BS detector, if you will?
No, this is a scandal that academia, for instance, we know the media just essentially reproduce they promote the agenda of the elites, whatever it may be.
Could you maybe just, I mean, you're a media critic yourself and a journalist, you've worked with the mainstream media, could you briefly try to explain why journalists and, you know, people who are often guided to these institutions because of their desire to get at the truth, why they themselves would be blinded to these realities, or are they just seeing their efforts being blocked from on high, or what is the infrastructure that allows that natural inquiry to somehow be blocked?
Yes, it's a very good and a very important question. The media are, if you will, a subculture. That is, young people who go to journalism school. I think you've just averred briefly to the suggestion, and I think it's true that they're idealistic and they want to tell the truth. This is one of the motivating factors of people going into journalism rather than going into public relations or the law or whatever. And so the young journalists start off they're wet behind the ears, of course, and it takes quite some time in any subculture to find out how it really works. That would be, you know, true of the mafia or the law, or whatever. And I know with my own experience, I was certainly idealistic, and I felt journalism was a noble calling. Really, calling, as my father was called to the ministry, I felt called to journalism. But what one learns presumably rises up the ladder somewhat to more responsible positions is how the system works. And one thing that is learned is that, and this can take a long time to learn, that certain subjects are to be avoided. And at the time, you don't have the full enough grasp of the larger picture to understand what a terrible thing that is. And in my own case, for instance, I'll just give a brief anecdote, but it stands for a lot of part of the answer to your question. When I worked at the Globe and Mail, there was a wonderful, actually, gossip columnist named Zena Cherry, and her beat was just the elite. It was the Rosedale crowd and so on. So when I just started on the Globe and Mail, I was simply on the police beat to begin with. That's the lowest you can be, and you know you get your feet wet. So when I was on the police beat, there was a call came over the radio squawker, the police squawker, that there'd been a break-in at the home of one of the Eatons. You know, the Timothy Eaton family.
Of course.
And so I thought, wow, this is important. It was a definite break-in, and apparently, you know, these burglars have made off with thousands of dollars worth of jewels and whatever. So it's got to be a story. I forget whether it occurred to me or whether the editor on duty at the time said, listen, call Zena Cherry. She knows all these people. So I got Zena Cherry's number, and I phoned her. You know, and I said, that's Barry Zwicker. I'm down on the police desk here at the Globe, and I've heard about this break-in at one of the Eaton homes, and I wonder if you can connect me to them. She said, you don't touch this, and she hung up.
Whoa.
And I went back to the editor, and I said, you know what, I can't get their number or anything. And it just dropped. There was never a story about it that I can recall. And so you learn these things by osmosis, if you will, or by these anecdotal experiences that tell you what's okay to report and what isn't. What do they love to
get put
on the front page?
There's an unwritten code, you're saying.
Pardon?
There's an unwritten code that there are some stories you just can't touch, which you learn through these sorts of experiences.
That's right. That's that. You've said it.
Okay. So is that also applying to academia? Is that why you find, for example, figures like Noam Chomsky, who would, you know, a lot of people tend to take their direction from them, and they're avoiding, you know, some of the questions about whether it's the Kennedy assassination or 9/11. They just seem to misdirect people. Is this a problem with their understanding, or are they perhaps deliberately misleading people?
Well, the problems with academia are terrible. They're equal to those of the mainstream media when it comes to studying and publishing about these highly significant events in world history that everyone should know about, because they are the tools of the trade for the elites that lead us into war after war. And so with the media, one of the problems, and we couldn't get to all of them, I was just, you know, we went through one sort of portrayal of how the individual reporter becomes acculturated to a culture of denial, if you will, and avoidance and promotion of other things without really knowing it. It just grows, and suddenly you find you're part of that system, and you question it or not. But ultimately, with the media, then the ownership, which is almost always private for profit, sets the value system at the top. Now, with academia, it's different because academia is not commercial. And so how does it happen that academia is equally delinquent when it comes to studying and publishing about, in this case of this conversation we're having, false flag operations? Well, some clues were given, as a matter of fact, this past September 11th here in Toronto, when there was the premiere of a documentary about 9/11 and academia. An excellent documentary by Adnan Zubairi, and there were three academics on a panel that discussed it, and one of them was Herb Jenkins, who's at McMaster University, and he noted that one of the reasons that academics fail to examine a big issue such as false flag operations is because academia is so specialized. The topic is really too big for them. Now, you said that Pearl Harbor was really a psychological operation, and I wouldn't agree in this sense. It was also a military operation. It was also an intelligence operation. It was also a governance operation. I mean, so it wouldn't be easy. Which discipline would tackle Pearl Harbor? Would it be the historians, the anthropologists, you know, particularly the military historians? They should, yes, but they're so tied in with the military, they wouldn't do it. And so with academia, you have that it's too big for anyone to take on. It falls between the gaps. It falls through the gaps, if you will, between the over-specialized disciplines of academia. That's one reason. Second reason is that academics are just as scared as other people about their careers, as journalists are, for instance. And so they don't want to rock any boats, really. They want to get plaudits for their research and their publishing, but they don't want it to be so far out that they'll be laughed at and scorned and will not get that tenure, that professorship, whatever it is they're after. And so there are two strikes against.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partner campus community radio stations across the country. We are also podcast at the site for the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. We're listening to an interview on the history of false flag operations with retired journalist and media critic Barry Zwicker, on the occasion of the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks.
And also, this is another factor that overlaps both the media and academia, and that is that the people within the media and within academia are also citizens out in the general culture, being brainwashed by what everybody else is being brainwashed by. And within those institutions of the media and academia, there will be standard shibboleths that are shared in the outside world too. Hopkins, who was the McLean's bureau chief on the West Coast for a time, called invisible axioms. You know, things that just people simply don't question. And so that's part of your answer.
Okay, and I was just wondering then, like, given those sorts of realities within our society, what kind of advice, constructive advice, would you be inclined to give to some of our activists who seem to be intent on getting some kind of justice for, say, 9/11, which another notorious false flag operation? What kind of approach should they be taking? Anything along the lines of pushing some sort of the agenda at the political level, petitions?
Well, of course, pushing at the political level. I've tried that to some extent myself with the New Democratic Party, with not very much success, but a little wee bit. So political activism, both the standard politics and street politics, if you will, both are important for activists to be involved with. The extra-parliamentary is more and more important, and especially with the Internet, the worldwide communications among clusters of like-minded individuals is very important. You might say that there are two essential considerations to reply to your question, well, what should activists do? Their study and action. Now, study and action are not, of course, hermetically sealed concepts, because when you take action, you learn something. You get out on the street, you might as well be studying, how to get street smarts. But to study, to sit down with a book, or to go on the Internet, or to call friends and discuss things with them, that study is also an action. So again, there's the slipperiness of words involved here. But anyway, we could, for the moment, say study and action. Now, the first thing, really, the earlier of those two has to be the study. And that really leads to a lifetime of gaining self-knowledge and knowledge of others in the relationship of oneself to the universe and everything. So that never ends. But when you apply it specifically to something like 9/11, it does mean that you have to go into what happened at the World Trade Center, what happened at Building 7, what happened at the Pentagon, what happened at Shanksville. There's just mounds and mountains of information to get, and then to weigh which is more important and which is less important information. And then to determine the quality of it. Which of this information would ring a bell with more of your friends and relatives and neighbors and member of parliament than others? Which is the hot stuff, the stuff that really nails it, and which is more peripheral and more open to question and argument and debate? I'm not against any of those, by the way, but the thing is, choose your battles, eh?
Yeah.
So first comes study, and then out of that will flow actions that one can take. You have to. Different people are in different positions. You, Michael, you've got a radio show. You've got more than one radio show. So you're a very privileged person. You have you have an outreach capacity that only a couple hundred people in Winnipeg at the most have. So you know, you have more responsibility, therefore, but so do your fellow broadcasters, be they commercial or non-commercial, the fact that they're not stepping up to the plate, well, that's what they have to answer for themselves. I've pretty well given up trying to sway members of the media, even old friends that I know, into taking an interest in 9/11. Their minds are so close to it now. It would be such a leap for them that they just can't contemplate taking it. So they're going to go through their lives being, sinners in that regard, whether they know it or not. And then each false flag operation is a separate matter. Now, as recently as last month, I wrote a piece for the Truth and Shadows blog, where my stuff is appearing nowadays, about the Guy Fawkes Day, the gunpowder plot. So that happened in 1605, and here I am writing about it still in 2012. And that's a valuable thing to do, because it's so far back in history that it really doesn't threaten anybody, but it can stand as an example. So that's a valuable thing to do. That's an action I'm taking. My slowly forthcoming book, False Flag Operations, History's Deadliest Deceits and Why They Matter, How to Spot Them, How to Stop Them, is my kind of contribution. I'm retired. I don't have nearly as much time as I'd like, but relatively speaking, I have time to work on a long-range project, a book just on the whole subject, and it will join almost no other books on the subject. It is just mind-boggling how false flag operations have been kept secret all down through history, right from the time of the Trojan horse, right on through to what's being planned for Syria to this very day. And because the rulers, they found this is a terrific tool for manipulating the public, getting what they want, as you said in the intro, launching wars, perpetuating wars. And so why would they give up the secret? I mean, if you had a secret recipe for a great salad dressing and you want to sell it, why would you give the secret away? Well, boy, they've been selling salad dressing for centuries now, and it's a very, very toxic salad dressing indeed.
Well, Barry, you've just ruined my appetite, but I want to thank you very much for sharing this background on false flags, and we'll look forward to having you back again on the show in the not-too-distant future.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. You're very patient with my sort of characteristic rants. But anyway, they're authentic, I'll say that, and there may be a nugget or two in there that your listeners may appreciate.
Okay. Barry Zwicker is the author of Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11, and he joined us from his home in Toronto. So I'm joined right now on the line by David Long. He's an Ottawa-based 9/11 activist. He's also an eyewitness to the actual 9/11 attacks. And he's joining us to tell us a little bit about some of the efforts within Canada to address the 9/11 question. So thanks for joining us, David.
It's a pleasure.
So, David, as I mentioned, you are based in Ottawa. May I ask how long you've been active on the 9/11 issue?
Well, I've been active since the day it happened. Mm-hmm. So that's more than a decade now, easily.
Yeah, could you mention briefly what it is that you witnessed that caused you to question the official story?
Well, I worked in New York for about a year and a half, and on the day of 9/11, I was walking to work, and what I saw was the initial explosion that hit, and when that happened, what I saw was molten metal coming out of the buildings. It was the strangest thing I'd ever seen, and I knew from that moment that something was really strange about what was going on. And there was a drill that we had when we were at Merrill Lynch. It was like a week before, where some guy came and told us, just in case you guys need to get out of this building, you're to go through these doors, down these stairs. And he was very serious about this. And, you know, after 9/11, I thought, why would somebody come in and give us a drill a week before it happened? We never had a drill, you know, and a whole bunch of stuff that was just very strange and didn't add up.
Was this one of the one of the Twin Towers?
Yeah, well, the drill was just like they gave us a drill on how to leave our building in case of an emergency, and that was before 9/11.
It wasn't actually one of the World Trade Center towers, was it?
No, I didn't work in the towers. Okay. I worked next to it on Broadway, but they gave us a drill, you know, so that seemed really strange to me, the molten metal. So over the years, I got to be more and more involved in the truth movement, and like many of us, now millions of us, I have a huge number of questions about what happened on that day. And we know that this is also the event that drove the Canadian invasion of Afghanistan along with the United States. It drove the invasion of Iraq, something that has resulted in the deaths of more than 600,000 people and millions of refugees. The costs, billions of dollars being spent on security, and the list goes on, all because of this event. So knowing the answers as to why, and not just what the official story says, but the real truth, it's critical to the progress of our nation, and every Canadian should be very, very concerned and wanting to know what the answers are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're here.
Okay, now, I first got in touch with you in the context of a cross-Canada effort to get one of the more high-profile personalities in the 9/11 truth movement, Richard Gage, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, just giving simple speeches across the country. And I know that at the event that was hosted here in Winnipeg, one of the audience members, just to back up, as I understand it, there was, it was an information session, but then it was followed by petitions that would to be presented to Parliament. And then that was going on at these gatherings across the country. Are we talking principally about just getting a new investigation, or are there allegations that go beyond that?
As Richard Gage correctly says, the important thing is that we first find out the truth about what happened. And there are consequences of that. The first step is to recognize and act on the facts and not the spin. And that's why we need to have an investigation. Where it goes, it doesn't matter. The important thing is that we get to the truth about what happened, come what may. And this is a great time for us because the petition asking the government of Canada to do that very thing is now in the hands of Paul Dewar, Member of Parliament. And there is a huge community of people in Canada, in the world now, that have this great opportunity to write to Paul Dewar, email and fax his office, and tell Paul Dewar how important this is to Canadians. And this next step now, where Paul Dewar hears what Canadians want and brings the petition to Parliament, this will start that process. This is a great time for us.
Now, there is a YouTube circulating in which showing some of the individuals in your group trying to convince Mr. Dewar to table the petition, and he seemed resistant. I guess I just want to know, first of all, do you believe that Paul Dewar can be convinced to table this petition, even though he's already signaled that he wouldn't?
Absolutely. We have told Mr. Dewar that we don't accept that answer and that we still want him to submit the petition in greater and greater numbers. Remember that Libby Davies, who also didn't want to submit the petition, there was so much pressure put on her by her own constituents that she had no choice to do it. And that is the power that, that we have. Our politicians are elected by us, and when in huge numbers people say to their member of parliament, do this, they have to listen to us, because if they fail to do that, they won't be reelected. And this is a time where all people everywhere in Canada, the world, all they need to do is speak. This petition gives the whole 9/11 truth movement focus, because now there's something that can be done. It's not just a debate on blog sites between truthers and people who still don't realize the truth. Now, politically, there's something that people can do, and it's so easy. Just email Paul Dewar, call his office, and ask him to submit the petition.
Well, what happens after the petition is actually tabled? I mean, is the government obliged to call an investigation?
They are obliged to respond within 45 days. The petition process is part of the laws of the land, and once it's submitted, the government is required to respond. Now, how they respond is another question. The important thing to know is that once it's submitted, the government has no choice. They have to respond, and that will break the silence, the wall of silence that we all face on getting the government, the establishment, to admit what the rest of us know. And then they have to go on record. Now, this petition is much more specific than the 2008 petition. We now have the benefit of all the research that's been done by accredited scientists, people like architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. And we're very specific about the evidence that we want the government to look at. This is facts like the use of thermite, evidence of explosives, the physical analysis. These are all undeniable, reproducible scientific results that we now have the benefit of, and this is what the petition is about. So it's a great time for Canadians and the world. This petition is there. There's a video about it that people can watch, and it's easy. All people need to do is just email or call Paul Dewar's office and tell them what they want.
You say that the science is very clear. Is there any peer-reviewed journal articles that you can point to that would lend gravity to the demands in this petition?
In the text of the petition, we specifically refer to the uncontested paper written by Niels Harrit with the chemical analysis of the World Trade Center dust. Yes, absolutely, there is peer-reviewed evidence, and plenty more. We cite the all of the evidence in the Blueprint for Truth DVD produced by AE 9/11 Truth, and all the evidence produced by AE 9/11 Truth. So there's plenty of accredited and peer-reviewed evidence in the petition. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so, like, what's the end game? Like, even if we do, like, even if you can, I mean, do you really expect that the Canadian government would approve of an investigation, or is this really just a way of teasing the government into addressing the issues?
This is a critical matter. Canada has invaded another country, and we are finding out now that the reasons that we were given for that are false. There could be no greater crime that a nation can commit than to wrongly invade another country. So whether or not there's an investigation in the United States, absolutely there has to be policy changes in Canada where we really check our facts a lot more. And it doesn't matter whether it's a partner nation like the United States, and you know, I am very supportive of the United States. I'm not anti-American at all. And I think it's important that we remember through all this process that America is our ally and always will be. But that being said, on matters of war and invasion and terrorism, it's clear that we need to, as a country, become much more circumspect. We need to have policies where we check our facts much more, especially involving things like terrorism. And there should be policy changes made permanent ones
the government of Canada. You're talking about things that should be taking place in an ideal world. I'm just questioning how they can be practically arrived at. I mean, it seems as if, you know, political entities can deceive the public all the time, right? So, I mean, are you being realistic here?
I think so. It's not in the interest of Canada to get involved in wars that are unjustified. And to do that puts the whole nation at risk. And that is something that's common to all Canadians, regardless of their political spectrum. We can't afford to make mistakes like that.
Are there any other are there any other strategies that you're encouraging Canadians to engage in to address the 9/11 campaign?
Right now, I'd say that we need to concentrate on Paul Dewar. As a movement, the next step, it's all about Paul Dewar. This petition is the most important thing that has happened in Canada for 9/11 truth ever. And what we all need to do is concentrate on Paul Dewar and get him to make that next step, which is to submit the petition in Parliament.
Okay.
That's our next step.
Okay. So is there a website you want to direct people to? Or
People can go to 911justicecanada.ca. There's a link there. It's easy. It says email Paul Dewar. All you do is click on that. It will create a pre-formatted email letter. All you do is put your name at the bottom and send it. That's all you need to do. If you want to call his office, you can do that. Paul Dewar is the easiest man to find. You can just look for him. We've got a link to his information on our website. And call. Put your voice there. You can also send a fax. And a great thing to do if people really want to help, write a personal letter. Just take out a piece of paper and write, "Dear Mr. Dewar, I live here. Please submit the petition to Parliament with no further delay. Thank you." And write it personally. And it's free to mail a member of Parliament. You don't even need a stamp. Just put that in an envelope, put his address on it at the House of Commons, and it will be delivered for free.
Okay.
You don't even need a stamp. So but there's two or three easy things that you can do, and we need people to speak out, and that's what Paul Dewar is going to hear. And when he sees how many Canadians... And remember, one in three people do not believe the official story. That's millions of Canadians. When he hears that, he will know what the people of Canada want, and that will compel him to submit the petition. That's the plan.
Okay. Well, David, thank you very much for sharing that with us, and all the best on your campaign.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to be on your show. You guys are great.
Okay, thank you. David Long is a 9/11 eyewitness and has been active within Canada on the 9/11 truth movement.
And now, a short feature by James Corbett of The Corbett Report on 9/11, a conspiracy theory.
On the morning of September 11, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat trained pilots on four commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down three buildings with two planes in New York. While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DoD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10th, 2001. Luckily, the news anchors knew who did it within minutes.
Osama bin Laden.
The pundits knew within hours.
Osama bin Laden.
The administration knew within the day.
Terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And the evidence literally fell into the FBI's lap.
That a hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists demanded an investigation into the greatest attack on American soil in history. That investigation was delayed, underfunded, set up to fail, a conflict of interest, and a cover-up from start to finish. It was based on testimony extracted through torture, the records of which were destroyed. It failed to mention the existence of WTC-7, Able Danger, PTEC, Sibel Edmonds, OBL and the CIA, and the drills of hijacked aircraft being flown into buildings that were being simulated at the precise same time that those events were actually happening. It was lied to by the Pentagon, the CIA, the Bush administration, and as for Bush and Cheney, well, no one knows what they told it because they testified in secret, off the record, not under oath, and behind closed doors. It didn't bother to look at who funded the attacks because that question is ultimately of little practical significance. Still, the 9/11 Commission did brilliantly answering all of the questions the public had, except most of the victims' family members' questions, and pinned blame on all the people responsible, although no one so much as lost their job, determining the attacks were
failure of imagination.
Because
nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings.
Except the Pentagon, FEMA, NORAD, and the NRO. The DIA destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on Able Danger, but that's okay because it probably wasn't important. The SEC destroyed their records on the investigation into the insider trading before the attacks, but that's okay because destroying the records of the largest investigation in SEC history is just part of routine record keeping. NIST has classified the data that they used for their model of WTC-7's collapse, but that's okay because knowing how they made their model of the collapse would jeopardize public safety. The FBI has argued that all material related to their investigation of 9/11 should be kept secret from the public, but that's okay because the FBI probably has nothing to hide. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise him, 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 and her. And her, and her, and him. Osama bin Laden lived in a cave fortress in the hills of Afghanistan, but somehow got away. Then he was hiding out in Tora Bora, but somehow got away. Then he lived in Abbottabad for years, taunting the most comprehensive intelligence dragnet employing the most sophisticated technology in the history of the world for a decade, releasing video after video with complete impunity and getting younger and younger as he did so, before finally being found in a daring SEAL team raid which wasn't recorded on video, in which he didn't resist or use his wife as a human shield, and in which these crack special forces operatives panicked and killed this unarmed man, supposedly the best source of intelligence about those dastardly terrorists on the entire planet. Then they dumped his body in the ocean before telling anyone about it. Then a couple dozen of that team's members died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. This is the story of 9/11, brought to you by the media which told you the hard truths about
his head could be seen to move violently forward.
And
they took the babies out of incubators.
And
mobile production facilities.
And
the rescue of Jessica Lynch.
If you have any questions about this story, you are a batshit, paranoid, tinfoil, dog-abusing baby hater and will be reviled by everyone. If you love your country and or freedom, happiness, rainbows, rock and roll, puppy dogs, apple pie, and your grandma, you will never ever express doubts about any part of this story to anyone. Ever. This has been a public service announcement by the friends of the FBI, CIA, NSA, DIA, SEC, MSM, White House, NIST, and the 9/11 Commission. Because ignorance is strength.
Global Research News Hour is broadcast every Thursday at 10 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM and on our partner stations across the country. You can download our podcasts from the Center for Research on Globalization's website at globalresearch.ca. I am host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.